All right. So I'm sitting here with Neil Ford. Neil, why don't you just start by introducing yourself?
Okay. I'm Neil Ford. I am a director at ThoughtWorks. I've been here about 10 years. I'm also a software architect. Most of my consulting work now is in the intersection of continuous delivery and architecture. And I also have, as part of my title, a meme wrangler, which is an unusual title in the tradition of ThoughtWorks unusual titles. Meme is the Richard Dawkins term for viral unit of thought. So a meme wrangler is someone who spreads thoughts around. So that's part of my job at ThoughtWorks as well.
So what is the thought you would like to spread today?
Well, it's really the kind of observation. There's really a lot of interest in the microservice style architecture out in the world right now. And it's really kind of the realization of why that's so popular. And I think it's because it's really the first post-DevOps revolution architecture. It's the first architectural style that really fully embraces all these lessons we learned from DevOps and the continuous delivery. And I think all architectures going forward have to take those things into account, because traditionally, the thing that's been tricky about architecture is it's hard to change later. In fact, that's one of the common kind of colloquial definitions out in the world for software architectures, the parts that are hard to change later. But if you look at someone like Netflix or Amazon, they've actually built changeability into their architecture, making change relatively easy in those worlds. So I think that by embracing those kind of operational constraints, you remove some of the restrictions that we've had in software architecture in the past, and that gives you a lot more business agility and the ability to respond to change a lot more aggressively.
Yeah. So you talked about the lessons we learned when we introduced DevOps. Can you elaborate a little bit on which are those lessons?
Yeah, I'll give you a perfect example of this, which is a common one in the kind of continuous delivery space. So from a software architecture standpoint, it makes logical sense to try to create single source of records for things. So you want a single customer service, you want a single customer database. It just, from a logical standpoint, you don't want duplication everywhere. So that makes
a
lot of sense.
The dry principle.
Exactly, it's the dry principle. But then you run into a situation like this. We have a client who was a major airline, and they had built an architecture like this where they had this Uber customer service, so that everything you ever need to know about customers were in this one consolidated service. And then a volcano blew up in Iceland, which means that everyone who had an airline ticket called the customer service center to this airline, and they all had to access customer records, which means that airline lost the ability to board airplanes, because they also needed customer records to board the airplane. But now that customer service is completely swamped, and so now essentially the entire airline shut down, because by building a single source of knowledge about something, they created an operational bottleneck. So by ignoring operations and just thinking about the architectural purity of the system, they ended up building a system that did not serve the business well. They would have had a better business case if they had two separate customer services that may have even been slightly out of sync, but still was able to keep the business in operation when unexpected circumstances.
So a single source of knowledge also meant a single source of failure.
Exactly. So that's the operational concern of architecture, not just the philosophical abstract ideas of architecture, but the operational practicalities of that architecture as well. We really need to start taking that into account. Otherwise, we build systems that are fragile needlessly.
Yeah. So nowadays, you would propose to solve that with two different microservices for two different aspects?
Exactly. That's a common thing that seems to go against the kind of architectural purity you normally think of, is you don't want duplication in your architecture. But when it makes sense from an operational standpoint, it actually makes more sense from the business. And in fact, a lot of this drive from the business to get every single thing we know about customer in one place, while that's a laudable goal, what real business purpose does that serve? I think it's okay for different parts of the business to have a different lens on what they think of as customer, and, you know, replicate some of the common data across, but let each one of those services keep the things that they care most about, rather than try to keep everything that touches customer have to deal with the entirety of customer every time. Let people have subsets of the information they need.
Is there still some strategy that you would apply to make sure you don't, like, have wrong data or contradicting data in the system?
Well,
or
certainly there is data that you care about not being contradictory, and so in that case, you know, maybe you force services to synchronize one another for very important things. So a lot of the practicality of a microservice world is you can say, well, we'll do eventual consistency between things that need to be real knowledge, and if we go after a record like an accounting record, we will wait and make sure that all the services are synchronized so we get a full story. Rather than try to cache something and get a faster result, we'll take a longer time and get the real result. So there are ways to build resiliency even into architectures like that.
Yeah. So this was like the first example. You had one source of information because it made sense like from an architectural standpoint, but from an operational standpoint, it didn't. What is another thing we learned from DevOps?
Well, it's just the idea that, so the way I've been thinking about this now is when you draw a whiteboard picture of an architecture, it's really kind of a three-dimensional view of an architecture, but we live in a four-dimensional world, so you have to think about time as how it applies to that architecture as well. So when you draw a box on a whiteboard that says ORM for Object Relational Mapper, you have to think, well, which version of Object Relational Mapper is that, and how am I going to upgrade that to the next version in 6 months when it comes along? So this operational thinking really drives a lot of how you think about upgrading core frameworks in your architecture. What does it mean to be able to change in an isolated way? One of the problems with layered architectures is you get the ripple effect. You can't change one piece without affecting all the other pieces because they share all that stuff in layers. In a microservices world, you can be a lot more aggressive about changing and keeping things updated more aggressively. That's kind of an architectural anti-pattern, is to let frameworks get way out of date and then have to struggle to update them. If you don't have as many things relying on shared infrastructure, then you're freer to update things on a much more aggressive basis, and so you can keep up to date with things more easily, and you end up incurring a lot less technical debt.
So, yeah, one aspect of microservices, of course, you have more moving targets these days. So I was thinking a bit, okay, microservices wouldn't have really worked before we have infrastructure automation. So microservices is kind of an offspring of DevOps. But still, if you have like networks, if you have thousands of services, how can one manage them?
Well, you have to build tools. You have to have engineering practices to be able to manage those services. So if you look at an architecture like Netflix, no single person can possibly understand what's going on at any given moment, but they have really good tools. They have ways of aggregating log messages. They've built specific tools to let them visualize what's going on with all these moving parts. This is definitely a much more complex architecture than a monolithic architecture. And it has a lot more moving parts that you have to pay attention to, but it also provides benefits in terms of easy ability to change things out. I mean, Netflix is a good example of this, where they can easily roll out new slight variations of core services and let people experiment with them, let people migrate over to them very easily without having to make major changes to their architecture or to do deployments and rollback deployments and all that stuff. So change becomes very easy. The ability to do really aggressive asynchronous kind of behaviors becomes a lot easier in this microservice world because you can spin things up really inexpensively and make them do work. So Amazon and Google show that, you know, how powerful this is. So there are definitely a lot of added complexities, but if you build them correctly, then you get a lot of extra added benefits too. So it's probably, for some companies, worth the extra cost of investment to get the benefits. If you're just building simple CRUD applications and going to a microservices world is probably more than you need, but if you have the business drivers for it, or you're in a really competitive market, then you can start leveraging some of those architectural gains to your business advantage.
So one thing we frequently struggle with is that when we go into a customer, they don't have a microservice yet and they don't have DevOps yet. Would you start with one or the other, or both at the same time?
I think you have to start with DevOps first. We've got a saying in the microservices world, you must be this tall before you start doing microservices, sort of like a carnival ride. I think DevOps is the first barrier to entry. If you're having to manually deploy services, you've already lost the game. So I think you've got to get a mature DevOps organization going before you can really start thinking about more advanced kinds of architectures to support that.
So you would start building up this DevOps culture, and then once it's running, start microservices? Or could you also, like, if DevOps has let's say, 3 months start, and then you...
Yeah, I don't think you have to have a DevOps initiative complete before you start spinning up microservices, but certainly you need to have some automation in place and some ability to programmatically control things before you really start getting serious with microservices. I mean, you can start with just a few services, managing them by hand, so it is possible to start at the same time, but before you really go live with it, you need a certain level of maturity in DevOps, I think, before you can really be effective. Before you get dozens or hundreds of services out there, you'd better have some maturity in the DevOps space.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Is there any other topic you would like to go into?
Let me think for a second. Let's talk about testing.
Testing, yeah. Testing microservices is always a big question.
So, of course, along with the extra complexity in the architecture, there's a lot of extra complexity in testing, too. So there's been a lot of thinking, and our colleague Sam Newman has done some interesting thinking about how do you test this. It's really a really intelligent testing of, you know, thinking about what moving parts you really need to test versus the things you can mock and stub. So there are some best practices around these kind of tests in, out in the world, but I think the important thing here is don't try to be super comprehensive and test everything through the entire architecture every time, because it takes a long time to get that all bootstrapped. So I think it's a good idea to have several intermediate testing levels using mocks or stubs or some sort of fakes or something like that along the way, so that you can build a good pipeline so you can test these things in isolation before you have to test them with all the moving parts. Because, you know, if you have a situation where you're only doing integration style tests with all those moving parts, it's going to break a lot and it's going to be kind of frustrating to deal with. So I think some a good level of sophistication around testing, and particularly a good separation of unit, functional, and integration testing, is key to make these kind of architectures work well.
Isn't it more likely that stuff goes wrong with microservices? Because, like, when you look at it, so we separated now the teams using Conway's law to model the communication, but we like separate the teams so they only have a very limited communication channel. Isn't this causing an integration problem?
It could potentially, and normally the way we solve that is with engineering practices like consumer-driven contracts is a really common way now to control. So we tend to, in this world, prefer the choreography style of integration architecture versus the orchestration style. Orchestration is kind of enterprise service bus or traditional service-oriented architecture where you have an orchestrator that controls routing and transformation and other sorts of logic. But that's not common in the microservices world because it really violates this domain-driven design bounded context idea. We're really trying to create this idea in the microservices world where each service is its own bounded context and none of its behavior is smeared out across integration architecture as you do in a traditional kind of service-oriented kind of world. So
so you need to try to make the microservices as such that you don't have so much integration going on between them?
Well, but any sort of logic that does require integration is completely encapsulated within the service. That's really this kind of bounded context idea reified into the microservices world.
So you have like a gatekeeper service to a bunch of collaborating services?
You might. So if you needed to aggregate or compose something, you might have a gatekeeper that aggregates a bunch of other services that gets, returns some sort of interesting information that you're wanting to get to. So, I mean, from that regard, these are a lot more complicated, have a lot more moving parts to them. So you have to have engineering practices in place to be able to manage that extra complexity that you end up spinning up.
So... when I move from a monolith to a microservice, how would you do that? Would you rewrite it?
Well, it's tricky. So you can decompose a monolith into microservices. So the real key perspective here from an architecture standpoint is that it's all about coupling. So software architecture is always the tension between cohesion and coupling. So when you have a monolith, it's all cohesion because there's no real external coupling. Everything is internally coupled. But when you start pulling that apart into services, now you have to start thinking about what used to be method calls are now service calls, and now they're out in your integration application architecture, not your application architecture. So one of the things you can do if you want to decompose a monolith into microservices is look at the existing coupling points and try to preserve as many of those as you can. And there are several different kinds of coupling points that are interesting here. One of them is the kind of traditional structural coupling, like efferent and afferent coupling, that you can get with tools like X-Ray or Independ. We'll report those kind of tools. And in particular, you can get a kind of a pie chart view of how everything is connected to everything else. And when you have one of those views, structurally, when you try to slice up your architecture, the fewer red lines you can break, the less coupling headaches you'll have in your new architecture. So one of them is to look at your classes or packages or namespaces structurally and think about what's the fewest number of lines I can snip. Another way you decompose a monolith is to think about temporal coupling, so transactions. What is transactional in this system? So very often, those transactional barriers are harder to replicate in a microservices world. So you look at the transactional characteristics of the existing monolith and maybe shave the services out for the transaction boundaries that already exist and worry about handling and breaking up that big transactional context later.
If you have really hard transactional requirements, does it even make sense to split it up?
It might not. It may be that you build a bigger service to handle that transactional context. So whether it's a microservice or a service-based architecture, there are advantages to both. So I don't think you failed if you take a monolith and get it down to services and don't make it all the way to microservices. I think you're still doing good work.
what does really make the difference between services and microservices?
Well, the main difference out in the world is that microservices tend to be completely autonomous from a DevOps standpoint. So service-oriented architectures tend to be more traditional kind of operationally. They tend to use things like enterprise service bus, use orchestration style.
So you might have more services on a single JBoss or
Well, typically, you'll have monolithic architectures even with your services, and they'll share a bunch of infrastructure versus microservices tend to be one-off and process-based rather than thread-based.
Yeah. So you might even spin off a whole new machine for Microsoft each time, or a whole Docker container.
Yeah, exactly. That's okay. Very common. Docker is very popular for that, to create those isolated deployments where only one thing is running in a container.
And I think Docker is an interesting thing because it would almost make no sense if you wouldn't want it to build microservices.
Right. It's you'd never build a Docker container and put an entire JBoss and all that other stuff inside it, because you might, but it seems like it's kind of defeating the purpose of building this big monolithic thing on a tiny little container like a Docker container.
Yeah. How would your architecture of a microservice tie into this load balancing idea?
Well, very often load balancing in the microservices world is done at the architectural level and the operational level, not within application servers, so it becomes part of your operational infrastructure, not part of your application architecture. So now you can start thinking about operationally, how do we spin up more services to handle demand? But that makes more sense for them to do it anyway, because they're handling that kind of scale anyway. So let's let them handle that. And if our architecture works well with our operations group, then that becomes an easy way to handle scale versus having to design our applications inherently to handle that kind of scale. So I think you can get, with a little bit of work, an actual simpler architecture that scales in the microservices world.
Yeah, so you would essentially use a front-end server to detect if the load goes up and spin just another service up. For that to work, microservices need to be stateless in a sense.
Or stateless, or at least own their own persistence mechanism. So there's nothing wrong with saying that it manages state, but it manages its own state entirely. And there may be even replication between microservices if you have more than one of them running and need to share some sort of context. But again, that would be a situation where if you absolutely had that scenario, you'd make a hard synchronous call to go get that information and make sure it's synchronized correctly across several services if you're really worried about data consistency.
Yeah, so every microservice talks to the same Oracle database is not a good idea.
Typically not, because if it's a real microservice, that means your microservice team is responsible for spinning that thing up. And if it's shared architecture, then it's going to be hard for you to do that. So that's why I think NoSQL and smaller databases are much more common in this world, because nobody wants to operationalize an Oracle database every time they spin up a microservice.
Yeah. So a good way would also be to have the database on the same machine, or is it?
Depends. This is very common. You'll have a Docker container that has the database and your microservice inside it because it's a very little amount of code. So typically in this microservice world, if you have persistence, then the microservice, as part of its bounded context, owns that persistence mechanism as well. That's another big change from traditional service architectures, which tend to share monolithic databases, whereas in the microservices world, they tend to own their own persistence mechanism.
Yeah. So the project I'm currently on created a monolith for 1 year because our way of working was more in the client. So we have a large client application, and the server really doesn't do the important stuff. So it's probably small enough to be a microservice, but it's just one. Are there still lessons we can learn that you would tell us?
Well, certainly the operational aspects of your architecture, I think that's a good lesson to take away from microservices. You need to start paying attention to that a lot earlier because of that. So one of the overarching kind of principles in continuous delivery is try to do things as eagerly as possible rather than putting them off as late as possible. So even if you're in a traditional kind of monolithic world, don't put off thinking about how you're going to put this in operations until the very last minute. This is really the nice thing about a deployment pipeline in the continuous delivery world, particularly when you have a deployment pipeline stage that starts programmatically configuring your environment, that forces the architect to start thinking about the operational concerns of what is it going to take to make this architecture work in the real world. You have to start thinking about that a lot earlier, and the earlier you can think about that, the quicker you'll get rid of issues that are going to cause you headaches later. So this is just part of the general philosophy of try to do things as eagerly as possible rather than put them off as long as possible. So if thinking about microservices encourages you to get operational for your monolith much faster, then that's a nice benefit that you get from that way of thinking.
Okay. Do you have any last words you would like to share?
It's really just this kind of realization that architecture is abstract until it's operationalized. So the more quickly you can get it operationalized, the more quickly you'll find out how it's going to react in the real world.
Operationalized means like putting it out in front of the customer.
Making it actually work on real hardware and real virtual machines in a realistic environment, in a production-like environment. I want to see it work as quickly as we can and then start iterating over making that work better.
Yeah, I like the term, real virtual machines.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Absolutely.
It was very interesting.